This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall.
And has the pandemic changed your reliance on your car? Jono, last big lockdown, I think I pretty much forgot how to drive and I put petrol in the car once in a matter of months. But this lockdown, it's very, very different. I'm driving more and I'm, to be honest, a little hesitant to get on public transport at the moment.
So what's changed? Why is it different this lockdown?
I'm not working from home this time around. First time I was. And I think that's the big difference for a lot of people here.
Yeah, fair enough. And we're really interested to hear from you today about if you're a one-car household and now thinking you might need to get a second car because you're trying to avoid public transport, or are you using your car less and thinking of getting rid of your car altogether?
That's it. Maybe if you are working from home, all of a sudden you look out in the driveway and you think, I haven't jumped into that car and even started it in weeks and weeks. Or maybe you're considering going electric. It feels like Groundhog Day when we talk about electric cars, but finally, electric car sales have actually turned a huge corner in this country. We've had more sales, Jono, in the first half of this year than all of last year put together when it comes to electric cars.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to cars today. As you might know, a pretty significant report came out today around infrastructure and planning around infrastructure and how that's changing because of COVID-19. What about car sharing? Is that still popular in a pandemic? Or are you hoping and waiting for driverless cars, autonomous vehicles? Will that ever happen in Australia?
I kept saying to my daughter, there's a very good chance you will never need to learn how to drive. That makes me happy because I would be the one that would have to teach her, no doubt. So what's happening with the car in your driveway? Are we relying on our cars more or are we relying on them less?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall. Maybe you can drive my car.
Love that bit. Love it. Have you been driving your car, though, or have you just been leaving in your driveway or wherever you store it? Or have you decided to get rid of your car? We want to hear from you today on The Conversation Hour. Graham Davison is the author of Car Wars, How the Car Won Our Hearts and Conquered Our Cities. He's an urban historian. Morning, Graham.
Good morning. How are you, John?
I'm all right. Is this a meteoric change to the way we use and think about cars in Melbourne and Victoria?
Well, I think it's like a lot of things. It's shaken up our assumptions, hasn't it? It's made us think again about how we get around and what we value. I mean, and like many people, I've been locked down and I've been rediscovering my neighbourhood and the beauties of walking. But, of course, I've hardly got on the train for months because, like many people, I've risen in the habit of using the train to get to the city probably several times a week, and I've hardly been there for months. And I suspect one of the things that COVID's done is shaken up our sense of space, of how we exist in urban space and what's safe and what's dangerous. And like you, I was interested to hear that Rochelle had the experience of hardly driving at all and then driving a bit more in this last lockdown. And I think that's been a pretty common experience. People feel, isn't it interesting that cars, people feel a sense of safety because they're enclosed with that, all that metal, and cut off from other people and in their own little zone. And I think that's part of the attraction of the car, is that sense of having a little space of our own.
Have there been other periods in our history, Graham, where, I mean, I know a pandemic is something huge and it's ongoing in our lives now, but have there been other periods where we've seen a really big shift in how we view and our reliance on the automobile?
Yeah, well cars, when cars first appeared, you know, more than a century ago, they tended to be expensive, available only to a few people, a bit in the way that I suppose electric vehicles are now. They're affordable only to a few. And it's really only in the post-war period, after about 1945, that we got this very rapid uptake of motor cars. And really within, I would say, 20, 25 years, we went from a city where a majority of people either walked or bicycled or took public transport to work to a city where overwhelmingly we used cars. And cars became really second nature to most of us who grew up in the post-war period. They were, and we saw them, I think, as liberty, as freedom.
Yeah,
that and you could go where you wanted to, when you wanted to. You weren't reliant upon crowd. I mean, public transport at the end of the Second World War was very overcrowded. A lot of people hated it simply because of the so-called strap hangers. You know, you had to hang on to a strap in the tram or train, and the car gave them liberty. And of course, very quickly the roads filled up. Then we got freeways that enabled us, we thought, to get around more quickly, and then the freeways got jammed as well. And then we started to think again, didn't we, about whether or not we were wanted to be as shackled to the car as we were, and we rediscovered the delights of density, of living in closer kinds of neighbourhoods where we could walk and so on.
What
COVID's done is kind of disrupted that again, I think.
Yeah. Well, just on that that congestion that you were just talking about there, about the freeways filling up, one of the potential solutions to that, I'm going to be talking about this a little bit more this morning as well, is this trial in four areas, so the City of Melbourne, City of Yarra, City of Port Phillip and the City of Ballarat, on how on using e-scooters. So they're going to be allowed to be used on roads, which could start, this trial could start within weeks, basically. Well, Gregory has called us from Fitzroy. And Gregory, what's your story?
Well, I sold my last car over 2.5 years ago and did get an e-scooter, and I haven't looked back. And any time I've needed a car, I've simply got a share car, and that's only maybe once a month. I do live in the inner city. And I'm 61, so I'm proud of it. Yep. So you can do
good
it even
you,
when you're older.
And is the share car still an option? I was thinking about that the other day, Gregory, because I was having a similar conversation with a colleague here, and they were thinking, oh, what do we do here? We're starting to think, maybe do we need a second car, but we don't. And they were talking about electric scooters, but share cars as well. But there's some hesitancy there, given the COVID world that we live in now, of sharing a car with strangers, basically.
Well, it hasn't concerned me. I mean, they purport to wash the cars regularly, but I also take with me some hand sanitizer and wipes so I can do my own self-protection if needed.
I have a few reservations about the Melbourne weather, the Victorian weather, and using scooters. How have you gone with that, Gregory?
Has not been a problem. Like, from the time to time, it doesn't rain as much in Melbourne as people think. It rains more in Sydney, but that aside, I've found it hasn't been a problem. The days when it's really raining, two things can happen. I can take my scooter and put it onto a tram because it folds down, and grab the tram and then get off, and when it stops raining, use the scooter again. Or if I get caught out, I'll grab an Uber and put it in the Uber and take an Uber. And the cost savings, I've done the sort of calculations, are thousands upon thousands of dollars a year. No parking, no fines, no petrol, no service, no insurance, blah, blah, blah.
And I think the monetary savings there is something that really makes a lot of people think about what you're doing as well. Gregory, thank you. Graeme Davidson is with you as well, the author of Car Wars, How the Car Won Our Hearts and Conquered Our Cities. And today we're looking at whether or not you're a household or an individual that is relying on your car more or less as a result of the pandemic. 1-300-222-774. It's interesting, Jono and Graeme, lots of kind of reasonings here around where you live and how, whether or not that impacts whether you have a car. So the suburb that you're in, or if you're in regional Victoria as well. One here saying, I made the tree change because of lockdown. We're going to be talking about that on Tuesday. A car has become indispensable. I can just walk to the shops. I can't walk to the shops no more. In fact, I had to purchase a second car. I couldn't survive with just one. Two cars, both doing 800 Ks per week. I love the tree change though.
Yeah, you will see this, just listening to Gregory from Fitzroy speak, it is easier if you've got the public transport system to fall back on, whereas in the country you just don't necessarily have that. And it is such a huge rite of passage in the country when you turn 18 and you're able to get your licence, and lots of people in the country do, because it's the only way to get around. So it's just, is that going to change, Graham? I mean, we're talking about...
Well, the other perspective I have on this, of course, is that it depends on stage of life, and it particularly depends on the itineraries of men and women. One of the things I notice is that the research really shows that although men in some ways seem to have more emotional investment in cars, it's women who are often actually more reliant upon them because they have complicated schedules that involve work and picking up kids and maybe shopping, maybe looking after elderly relatives and so on. And in practice, you analyse their days and they really, really hard put all of those activities together on an electric scooter.
Yes.
They're really far-flung, complicated journeys that really require a lot of planning usually. So
and outfits. I hate to make it about clothes, but I keep thinking, man, I'd have to carry a second pair of shoes because, you know, the shoes that I wear are not going to be appropriate for an electric scooter.
That's right. I mean, I'm at the stage of life too where, again, I cycle a lot. And I'm probably at the point now where I'm beginning to think about maybe an electric bike too, because some of those hills are starting to get a bit steeper suddenly enough. but there's lots of opportunity within localities, and some of this goes to the question of how we now plan our cities. If we were able to actually have more activity concentrated in a polycentric city where people could get within the so-called 20-minute city, I think we would then begin to be able to be much more reliant upon these other forms of active transport.
We'll certainly go into that in detail.
Gregory's right.
On Tuesday. Sydney plan our cities.
Than we do.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what we'll be looking at given the infrastructure report that's come out and, you know, different cities and what we're going to rely on, especially too because there is such a mass exodus. Around 22,000 people from the CBD, from the area of Melbourne, have moved to regional Victoria and how we're going to plan those regional city centres as well. Graham Davison, thanks so much for your time. Author of Car Wars, How the Car Won Our Hearts and Conquered Our Cities. Jono, this is a text from Glenn in Ferntree Gully. Bought an old VN Commodore wagon for $50 a couple of months ago. It hadn't run for 16 years, full of rubbish, etc. It's now going like a legend, and we're going to put it on Club Retro. So when we lockdown finishes, we'll take it out on weekends for a cruise. It has bumps and rattles and real character. We love it. $50.
Wow, that's very cheap, very cheap. But on e-scooters as well, that was a real realisation for me in between lockdowns last year, going to Melbourne. I hadn't been for a while and just noticed these scooters everywhere. This text says, get the e-scooters off the footpaths, please. They are a menace. I and others have nearly been hit several times. And that's part of this trial. I guess it's to be more accepting of e-scooters as a legitimate form of transport, because there's going to be a trial in City of Melbourne, City of Yarra, City of Port Phillip and City of Ballarat to allow these scooters to actually go on roads. And as long as they don't go over 50 kilometres per hour, they're allowed to travel on roads. So it's kind of legitimising them a little bit and maybe taking them off footpaths. But, gee, they are just everywhere. Mm.
This text, hi, we haven't been a one-car household for 18 years. Or we have been, apologies, a one-car household for about 18 years. I estimate that we save about $175,000 in that time. We now have a third driver and we negotiate access. I am the rider in the household. Well, Mike Sinclair is from Car Sales. He's the editor-in-chief. Mike, what's the trend at the moment? Are people getting rid of cars or buying cars?
It's certainly increasing car ownership. Since the start of the pandemic, the research we've been doing, and I think it's borne out when you look at the price of cars currently, people want to add cars to their households.
It's the price, but it's also the waiting times. I've heard stories of people going into dealerships and saying, yep, I'll sign on the dotted line, I want to buy a car, and then they have to wait 3, 4, 5 months until it turns up.
Look, there's a bit of a perfect storm in new car availability currently. Certainly the global chip crisis is not helping. Closures of factories during the pandemic has been an issue. But I think generally there's significantly more demand for cars as people have been reluctant to use public transport, or indeed have been advised by their employers, if they're coming to work, don't use public transport. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why Aussies are getting back into car ownership and doing it with a substantial amount of vigour.
Gosh, it's going to be interesting to look at the long-term impacts on this, because for a very long time now, you know, people have been trying very hard to drive less, to do the more environmentally friendly option. I mean, I guess there is the positive side in this, in that there has been an uptake in electric car sales. But as we've discussed ad nauseum on this program in particular, is that they're not accessible to a lot of people. They are often quite expensive. But Mike, I was also reading today that just getting parts for cars is really tricky now, and importing them. You know, one person gets COVID in a factory in Japan, and the onflow effects that has to us here in Victoria is huge.
A lot of this goes back to the fact that modern manufacturing, just-in-time manufacturing, has meant that there really hasn't been the backlog of parts to supply any sort of or to survive any sort of breakdown of that supply chain. So you have companies and factories all around the world have been really looking at upstream to their suppliers on what they can do and when they can supply stuff. What also happens typically is that there are two sort of different supply processes. Spare parts are usually built in a different sort of supply chain to the actual OEM parts, the parts that go in the car for manufacturing. They're done in different lots, and that has been an effect. The other thing that's been typically coming through is that manufacturers have been narrowing the range of vehicles they've been building as the chip shortages hit. So they're typically manufacturing higher spec and in the reality, more profitable vehicles, and perhaps some of the other vehicles have been pushed to the side momentarily, and that also applies for the parts for those vehicles.
Mm. Mike Sinclair is with us, Car Sales Editor-in-Chief. And just hang there for a second, Mike. We've got Kate, who is in Seaford. Kate, what's your story?
We are sharing a car at the moment. My little old car died last November, and my youngest son decided to purchase a car. And I thought, well, let's give it a go. I was working from home. He was working from home. My other son gets a lift in the morning. He's got a permit to work. So we've been living with one car for the best part of a year, and it's worked out really well.
Wow. And do you reckon that would have been possible without the pandemic?
I am very much a public transport user, and when I work, I'm usually close to home, so I do use public transport. But I thought we'd give it a go during the pandemic and just see what happened, and really we've saved a lot of money, to be honest.
Isn't that interesting?
When you take into account registration, insurance, roadside assist, petrol, servicing, all that kind of stuff, it all adds up. It's a lot of money.
Yep, and I think I'm trying to teach a little bit of responsibility about, well, it's a privilege for a lot of people to own a car. Do you need to use it every day? Is it a matter of social status? Why do we need three cars? I was dreading the thought of having three cars in the driveway.
Yeah. I love a woman too that can find a little bit of a life lesson for a child in anything that happens, Kate.
I know, terrible.
I do it all the time. I love it. I think it's really great. And you raise a good point. Deb in Richmond says here, this is a great conversation. When I was researching whether or not to get a second car, and this was around 10 years ago, I read an article by the RACV that said it was cheaper to take up to 5 taxi rides anywhere in metro Melbourne rather than buying a second car. I took their advice. So, Kate, thank you. Would you agree with that, Mike Sinclair?
Look, I think that's a really good point, and particularly with the democratisation of transport, with the brands, with the ride-sharing brands, which have pushed the pricing down and pushed availability up, that's certainly an option. I live in the inner north of Melbourne, and certainly during the pandemic period, my cars have been parked. We've barely driven them. The change will come when we're unlocked again and people need to get to work. And then have that balance of whether they want to take public transport or whether they want that personal mobility. But there's lots of ways of travelling. Motorcycle sales are up, scooter sales are up. So consumers are keen to have that sort of personal mobility, and there's different ways of doing it.
That's really interesting. Car sales are up, motorcycle sales are up, scooter sales are up. Look, we're really interested in hearing if taxi use is up and Uber use, because anecdotally, as Rish was saying, we're hearing that not as many people are, you know, using rideshare services and using taxis, but we'd love to hear from you about whether that is spot on. Also want to ask you about electric vehicle sales, because we got this text earlier saying, waiting for an electric ute, until then I'll keep repairing my LPG ute. So some people are a bit reluctant to change over. What's happening with the rollout of electric vehicles in Australia, Mike?
I think the key thing is that we have literally dozens of brands announcing globally that they will move to fully electrified or fully electric fleets, you know, in the next decade or so. So that electric ute's coming. In fact, there's a couple of American utes coming that will be available probably next year that are fully electrified. The transition to electric vehicles and electrified vehicles is inevitable. It's coming. It's coming reasonably slowly at the moment. There are affordable electric vehicles available in the Australian market now, but the choice is not there, and there isn't necessarily the type of vehicles that consumers want. And remember, Australian consumers love SUVs. So that's really where, once those affordable, attractive and also, usable vehicles start to arrive being fully electric, I think you'll see the uptake.
Yeah, well, it's a perfect segue to our next guest, and maybe he'll be able to make comment on that. So Mike Sinclair, thanks so much for your time. Car sales editor in chief. But Bayad Jafari is the CEO of the Electric Vehicle Council, and you're just listening to Mike there. Would you agree?
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I absolutely agree. Look, more particularly larger SUV and sort of ute-style electric vehicles are coming around the corner. Some of the big American brands, where Americans who like driving even larger SUVs and larger utes than us, are making those electric vehicles now, and they'll sort of get access to them first and then they'll make their way here. But I think they're really, you know, yes, there are a lot of people who like utes and who drive utes, but there are a lot of other people who also have, you know, just standard cars or small SUVs or what we call crossovers, and there are electric options available to them as well. So, I mean, there's no need to wait. You know, there are options already, and that's only going to continue to grow.
What's the cost of that, though? If someone wants to buy an electric ute, or at least, I mean, the common criticism for many years has been, oh, well, I can't tow anything in an electric vehicle. So when I get an electric vehicle that can tow a caravan, a boat or whatever, then I'll think about it. But what would that cost you to buy an electric vehicle that could tow something?
Yeah, so, I mean, today, electric vehicles, the ones that we have in our market today, sort of starts at, and these are all new vehicles, you have to remember, started at about $39,000 all the way up to, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So all of those different options are there. Where if we're sort of talking about utes, well, there is an electric ute, so it doesn't matter how much money you have. You don't have the option to buy one just yet. Yeah. But yes, only when they come. Yeah, if you look at the type of utes people are buying, they're generally around, you know, $50,000 to $80,000. There's that sort of cheaper ute market is, it's interesting that ute market is getting more expensive because people want utes that can both be their work vehicle as well as be a comfortable family vehicle. So it's almost doing two things in one there. And that, of course, adds cost to the cars. Look, the good news there in that, what is it electric vehicles are capable of doing and how much do they cost in order to do it? That's really all a conversation about batteries, right? And that's the new thing about electric vehicles. Instead of an engine, they have a battery. And there we've seen just the cost of those batteries falling dramatically. So whether it's the ones that you put on your home or the ones that go into the car, the cost of them falling dramatically while their power and performance goes up. So we're seeing this double improvement in they're able to do a lot more while getting cheaper at the same time. And when we look at that from a new technologies perspective, I think, you know, it's not that foreign, because people can think about it like their mobile phones or their laptops or anything else, or, you know, TVs, of they just keep getting better and keep getting cheaper all of the time.
And I think that's the thing. A lot of people have been waiting, haven't they, saying, oh, we'll wait till, you know, the technology catches up, or we'll wait till they become more affordable. And some of the data has shown this year that there have been as many sales in the first half of this year, which is the same as all of the sales of the year before. We've seen another company that's looking at coming in and putting in, I think, around 500 charging stations across the country. So the concept of range anxiety is falling away as well. But at the same time, we're seeing that parts aren't making it from overseas because COVID is holding up for so many different reasons, whether it be that staff are quite literally getting COVID-19 or we're seeing issues with imports and exports. Are we actually getting the cars? Because anecdotally, I've also had someone else say to me, I wanted to get an electric car, but I was told I needed to go onto a waiting list.
Yeah, we're seeing this right across the car market, so not just electric vehicles, but any new car that you're looking to buy. Both, you know, a lot of things are happening at once, unfortunately. You know, there's COVID, it's provided a bit of a slowdown. There's also this global chip shortage, a computer chip shortage, and that impacts, you know, laptops and gaming hardware and sort of vehicles and everything else as well. Everything's got a computer chip in it these days, essentially. And so it doesn't mean that you can't get it, but it just means that, yeah, that those waiting lists are generally a little bit longer now because, you know, people are trying to source these things and try to move them a bit faster. And that also, I guess, depends on which brand and which one you're looking to buy. So if you're looking to get a car right away and you want to put it on the road right away, shop around a bit for a few different brands. Some people already imported their products here and it's ready to go. Others, the ones who are, you know, need to fill that order by putting it on a ship from overseas, that's going to take a little while longer at the moment.
Yeah, and there seems to be a real difference between the need for a car in the country and the need for a car in the city, because two texts illustrate this perfectly. Christian in South Melbourne says, I scratch my head when I read about how so many people are leaving the city for coastal or regional areas as a result of COVID-19. Sounds like car dependence and ownership will be on the rise, along with congestion on our roads. And Anne says, I sold my car in 2008 when I lived in St Kilda, but I had to buy one when I moved to the Wimmera to take advantage of cheaper real estate. It's always a balance. And that just perfectly illustrates, I guess, the lack of public transport in regional areas.
And that will come into, I guess, our conversation on Tuesday as well. You know, when we're talking about big infrastructure changes and what needs to happen, transport, roads, public transport is such a big part of that. Kelly's in Geelong. Hi, Kelly.
Oh, hello. Good morning.
Good morning. What did you want to say?
So I wanted to say that we've recently, as a family, we're a family of five, we're sort of now five adults, have purchased an electric vehicle, and my daughter's also just got an e-bike, so that's going really well. I made a conscious decision last year to really, if the journey that I was making was, say, less than 5 kilometres, I was just going to ride my bike, and that proved fantastic, and I just had to be really disciplined to do that all the time. But I just want to say as well, in terms of like the road infrastructure, it's so unfriendly to cyclists. It's just the roads are there have been built for cars, and I totally understand that, but it just is a disincentive for people and particularly children to get on their bikes.
That's such a good and strong point. You know, the roads are built for cars, and without me continuing, Jono, to bang on about what we're talking about on Tuesday, but if we were to start again, you know, like if we were to look at, okay, well, how do we build these roads? We probably build them differently, but then are we relying on road freight more than train freight, or, you know, what do we need our roads for and who are we trying to build them for?
Yeah, spot on. And it's so hard to remove all of that infrastructure and start again. You've got to build around it. Behad Jafari is with us, the CEO of the Electric Vehicle Council. Now, I've seen some commentary, Behad, that Australia will end up being a graveyard for petrol vehicles because we just don't have the economy of scale here, because there's not enough people and there hasn't been really any legislation change to make it to bring in a lot of electric vehicles here like there has been in Europe. So a lot of the car manufacturers with electric vehicles are going to be sending a lot of them here. Do you think that will happen?
Look, the concern there is it's not so much about the scale and size of our country. It's the job of our governments to play a coordinating role, like with any new technology, whether it's the internet rolling out or, you know, mobile phone coverage rolling out. And what we're constantly hearing from the automotive sector and the broader transport sector is, look, it's not just Europe that's taking these actions. It's every other developed country in the world is saying, okay, this technological change is happening and here's our plan for it. And at least at a national level, that's not occurring here in Australia. The government's been promising to put a plan together for a few years, but still hasn't gotten around to it. We've now got states trying to push ahead and saying, well, we'll start trying to fill that gap. You have to remember, you know, we don't build cars here, so you have these global companies when it comes to where they're going to be sending their products and where they're going to be sending their new technology saying, well, every other country in the world has a plan in place, and when one doesn't, that raises a bit of a red flag to us. So how can we properly factor you into our plans when you guys don't have one of your own? So maybe the answer is we're going to keep sending you the older technology for a longer period of time, not forever. I think, like with all new technologies, you know, there's going to come a point where there's no choice to be made. They're all electric vehicles. It's just how, you know, will there be a tail attached to that? I think the answer is hopefully not, because yes, that's a concern right now, but it's entirely within our power to change that concern. We should sort of see that more as a cautionary tale rather than what's going to happen in Australia.
And Behad, while we have you, just finally, Marcus in Pakenham has a point that I think you'll be able to answer. Marcus, welcome. What did you want to say?
Yeah, look, it's more about this government, a Victorian government, what I think seems to be a retrograde step is this tax on how much you use your electric vehicle. Surely if we're going to be going to this new technology, isn't that a backward step rather than a forward step?
I think a lot of people felt that same way, Behad, when the tax came out before people were even buying the vehicles. It was sort of almost a bit of a disincentive. Would you say that?
Yeah, look, we were really frustrated. I mean, there's a very smart way to do these things. Yes, the new technology requires reform to the way that we tax things. Governments need money to pay for things. That makes perfect sense. And we saw a really smart way of how that can work here in, I live in New South Wales, here in New South Wales, where the government said, we're going to spend these next few years setting up our plans, encouraging people to buy electric vehicles. And then later in this decade, when the market has had a chance to take off, then we're going to start introducing new road charges, you know, new sort of essentially doing tax reform structures where, what the Victorian government did was say, we're going to introduce the tax and we'll get it, you know, the next step of we will get around to planning about what to do to support the technology. And we'll say, well, that's backwards, right? Yeah. When this new technology provides a whole range of benefits to society and to people more widely, focus on the benefits first and then worry about how you're going to clip the ticket on the way through a bit later.
Thank you very much for explaining what's happening and giving us an update on electric vehicles in Australia, Behad Jafari, CEO of the Electric Vehicle Council, speaking to us from New South Wales. Dr. Kirsten Alford is a futurist and director of the Museum of Discovery at the University of South Australia. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Do you think our relationship with the car in Australia has changed irreversibly during the COVID-19 pandemic?
I think it's too early to tell, but I think there are some signals that people are not taking up public transport as much now post-COVID as we might have thought when we were thinking about climate responses. So, you know, we can see that people are preferring to drive in. We're seeing that people are, preferring to use their own forms of transport, perhaps if they have that option, rather than using public transport. So I think that does sort of change the expectations we might have had about what transport solutions look like in the future. And coupled with that, I think, is some of the urban design considerations. So, you know, we had this push towards, you know, medium and high density housing and apartments, and they're not great places to be during a pandemic or during a lockdown. And so we might start to see, you know, that spread and move towards more low density again, which then kind of makes us rely on cars further as well.
Yeah, gosh, there's so much to think about once you start to dive into this. Kirsten, I keep saying to my daughter, look, you probably will never have to learn to drive, you know, that we will have driverless cars. Is that ever going to happen, do you think? I mean, maybe they're sort of totting around San Francisco, but what's the likelihood of them coming to Victoria?
Oh, I have to laugh because I've currently got three daughters on their learner's permits and I wonder if they're ever going to learn to drive. I think there are different considerations to kind of think about. So one is kind of thinking about what the requirements for young people driving are. What is their access to study? What is their access to work? So again with COVID, we're seeing a lot of the you know university study go online. There's less requirement to be on campus, and so that reduces one you know key requirement to drive. And of course, you know, with the if you are driving into the city for recreational purposes, you're more likely to Uber or get public transport so that you can have a drink or any of those sorts of considerations. So I think there is kind of asking what is the need to drive there. I think if we're looking at the pickup of autonomous vehicles, really that we have to sort of ask our priority about where we think what type of vehicles should be our priority first. And usually when we come to automation, we prioritise things that are dangerous and repetitive for people. You know, so the runabout town is probably not the priority. It's probably trucking and logistics for autonomous vehicles that might be the priority, or routes that are repeatable, like, you know, park and drive type routes where you might be able to sort of pick people up in more of a public transport option. So I'd have to say that the individual self-driving car seems like it's still a fair way off to me.
Yeah, me too, actually. But I guess it depends on the road infrastructure as well. And as Rish was saying earlier, the road infrastructure was built for a certain type of car to be driven in a certain type of way. Do we need completely new roads to make autonomous vehicles a possibility?
Look, I think we don't get the benefits of autonomous vehicles unless we change the system that we're driving within. And so, you know, the advantage of having an autonomous vehicle, autonomous vehicles on the road is that they're talking to each other, they're sensing each other, they're giving each other messages. And so you don't need a set of traffic lights to tell you when to stop. So the frustration of being pulled up at a red light, well, you know, nobody's crossing in front of you. The autonomous vehicles should be able to relate that to each other. And so, you know, that whole structure that we've got and those road rules that we've got are kind of inhibiting the real benefits of having an autonomous vehicle thing for starters. I mean, the other stuff is around parking. So, you know, it's a bit pointless autonomously driving yourself into the city and then parking if your car can just autonomously drive itself home.
Oh, no, so much of it is so strange. And my husband is a little bit obsessed with driverless cars, and I was saying, yeah, but, you know, they'll be with people that aren't in driverless cars, and how will they be able to read and talk to each other? And he was telling me about this particular research that was done where they sort of, almost like a computer game, but sort of threw everything at this driverless car. If you imagine a ball coming out and a kid and a kangaroo and other cars and someone trying to run an amber light, and basically this driverless car read the room perfectly and navigated its way through all of these elements that would have caused most of us stress. How possible is it to have sort of, I guess, both worlds talking to each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really tricky. Like, I think about our family, and we still drive a car from 2004. And so when we look at the emergence of any technology, you're going to have this lag as well. So you are going to have this world in the transition. I that's what we would expect, that you would have this world where you've got very, very new technology of cars that may be able to do that, combined with people like me who are still driving cars from 2004. So I think that's where it gets trickier. And I think one car being able to manage all of those things is different from a system of cars managing all of those inputs. So we can see that we're not there yet. I mean, this week there was news about a Tesla crashing into a parked emergency vehicle on a freeway. That's about the 11th crash they've crashed into emergency vehicles on freeways. So, you know, the technology is still not being able to detect objects in their path. So we're still developing that technology, and I don't think we're not very good at combining the brand new technology systems with the lag systems generally. So yeah. I do think it poses some problems.
Still a little way off yet by the sounds of it. But just before we let you go, Dr. Kristen Alford, we just filled out the census forms recently, so we don't have the latest figures, but the census shows that in Australia there are about 17 million cars, and we've got a population of about 25 million people in Australia. So that's the equivalent of 92% of households have a car.
Gosh, that's high, isn't it?
It is. 1.8 cars per household. We love our cars in Australia. What's going to happen to that rate, 1.8 cars per household, what will COVID do to that?
I mean, it's really interesting because if you look at a lot of the data shows that most cars are, you know, are taking one person places, and yet we insist on having these, you know, these cars that can take sort of five or seven people places. And again, it's a little bit like the infrastructure question around electric cars. If you were to design a road system for people having their own individual mobility, you wouldn't design a road system that requires a car that's the size and shape of the cars we have now. You might design something that looks more like the tiny smart cars or your own individual bubble or some kind of thing that looks like a cross between a motorcycle and a small pod. But of course, those sorts of vehicles would not be at all safe given the other infrastructure that we've got at the moment.
Yeah.
So I think there are really interesting considerations when you look at, you know, if you could start again, you know, what would you do to help mobility around cities? So, I mean, I think we're kind of stuck with a fairly set infrastructure. Our cities are designed around the car. You know, we don't see the investment in public transport infrastructure. I think COVID makes that, you know, more shaky as well in terms of consumer preferences. So I think we'll see, you know, that continual love of the car. It gives us freedom, it gives us flexibility. But there are new models that might emerge with self-driving cars, like, you know, like the fact that we might not own them, we might do more car sharing of vehicles, a bit like we've moved towards the Ubers. So I think there is still movement for innovation within the system.
It's interesting to think about. Dr. Kristen Alford, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, thank you.
Futurist and Director of the Museum of Discovery at the University of South Australia. So many texts on this, Jono. One is from Anne in Hampton. Two neighbours, each house has four adults, four cars. And another is from Steve, and it says, this discussion is very city-centric. In the country, we need vehicles so that we can travel distances. But it's sort of interesting. It sort of is and it isn't, because we've had texts saying, well, I actually don't need my car as much now because I can just walk to everything that I need because I live in regional Victoria. And if we look at decentralisation and our reliance on the city. If you take that away, do you need a car as much?
And in lockdown, if you've got the 5K zone, can kind of walk to places. You can ride places. That's what Suzanne is doing. She's sent a text here saying, we're a family of five living in Lilydale and our bicycles are our number one form of transport. This was even pre-COVID, she says. For work, shopping, kinder drop-off and school, we bought a solar cell to charge our car battery as it would go flat. Integrating exercise into our everyday lives has always been our priority. And good on you, Suzanne. I mean, that's great to hear that, but I just wonder if that works for everyone, because we do lead complicated lives, Rish.
I know, but you've got to work out what works for you, I guess, don't you? And this is interesting too. I hadn't even thought about this. This is from Brendan in Mernda. Playing local sport, back when we could play local sport, and let's just assume that we're all going to play local sport again. Especially if you're in the regions, right? You're reliant on cars is really important, because depending on who you're playing against, and even out in the suburbs as well. So, you know, you might be in Werribee and you have to play against Geelong or Dandenong or Bendigo. And yep. I know friends of mine, her daughter plays hockey and they had to travel. I think it was, you know, it was going to take them at least an hour and a half to get from one suburb on one side of Melbourne to the other. It was a huge commute for her to go and play hockey. So sport does come into it.
Yeah, for sure. I remember when I moved to Melbourne for uni, when I was in my, late teens, early 20s, and I thought, oh, on the weekend, there'll be hardly any traffic. And then you hit the Monash on a Saturday morning and there's heaps of
Saturday
traffic.
Don't get me started on Saturday traffic.
Yeah, but that text was really spot on about there being different requirements in the country compared to the city. So thank you for pointing that out. Let's have a chat with Daniel, who is in Coburg. G'day, Daniel. What's your situation?
Hello. I just want to say that I've got a friend who hires a car one weekend a month, 12 times a year. And he's worked out that it's much, much cheaper than paying insurance and the mechanical costs for the vehicle, like tyres, oil and that sort of stuff. And I found this concept to be very, very interesting.
Isn't that? That is interesting. This is sort of a little different, but I remember reading this article years ago and someone had figured out that it was cheaper for them to stay, because they had to commute between the city and the country, it was cheaper for them to stay permanently in a beautiful five-star hotel during the week than it was for them to rent a small apartment. By the time you look at, you know, your electricity, utilities, your Wi-Fi, gym memberships, all that kind of stuff, they were staying in this incredible hotel. So, it's almost the sort of same concept.
Yeah, quite interesting, isn't it, when you break down the costs and really micro-analyse. So he's a smart fella.
He's a smart fella.
And it just takes the will to actually do that, to break down the costs and actually do it.
Oh, gosh, that involves lists and some kind of, you know, looking
and
at
spreadsheets.
Oh, don't say that term, Jono. This is a good text. If I want to go to Bunnings, I can't take 20 kilos of concrete on the bus.
Yes. The other one is school pickups, kinder pickups, drop-offs, et cetera, et cetera. Tim is in Melbourne. Morning, Tim. What's your point?
Good morning. I think we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. I mean, we had a perfect example recently at Queen Victoria Market. There was a donut festival which had huge crowds, but the council's they want to close the main car park at the market. They're taking a lot of the off-street, on-street car parking away. They're making the streets much narrower. And, I think they just went well ahead of themselves. There's still a huge demand. And with the 5-kilometre lockdown, the fruit and veg eaters here are just doing no business at all.
So still a big demand for car spots at the market. Tim, thank you. I remember years ago reading something, Jono, where one of the owners of one of the really big shopping centres in Melbourne was looking at what their 10, 20-year plan was for multiple levels of their car parking as they started to predict that people would car share more, that there would be driverless cars and that they had all of this real estate. Because if you think about the amount of car spaces that are dedicated to any shopping centre, it's going to be something, you know, that takes up a lot of space. So looking at that reliance on car spots, something else I hadn't thought about is, you know, it's much safer for women to have a car with night work, et cetera. And I know I probably wouldn't get on public transport on my own of an evening. So that's a big part of it too.
Yeah, spot on. And just a few texts here. This one says, shopping for me is a 200-kilometre round trip through the mountains. An electric car would not cut the mustard, says Rod at Woods Point. But it's different for Helen. Helen says, I started riding to work last year and still do it. Our demand on our cars has reduced enormously. So different horses for courses, Rish.
That's it for the Conversation Hour today. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget you can always subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast. You can go to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and that way you'll never miss an episode and you can share it with your friends and family. And if you have an idea or someone or something you want us to talk about, you can email us, conversationhour@abc.net.au. We always read those emails. Take care and speak to you soon. We'll